doesn't happen for Palestinians, right? So it's not the Palestinians' fault that all of this is happening. It's the fault of the people who, you know, want the genocide to continue so they can continue to line their pockets and have regional power or whatever interests they have. Meanwhile, the people unanimously, globally, even here in the United States, have made it very clear we don't want this reality for us or for people we've never even met overseas.
Well, thank you, Ren Jitan, the Adala Justice Project in Glen Carbon, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us here today on Flashpoints.
Yep, thank you, Kevin. Appreciate you.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root this mountain down. Wish I was a mole in the ground.
We live in a boomtown metropolis. Place where success is a weapon of war. Some people live in spectacular mansions. Some people can't afford to live anywhere anymore. But Bezos has the money. He's got all of that money. More than $100 billion in his pants. Way down. You don't have the right to use that name. Amazon, it is a nation and a people. Amazon, one of the world's greatest rivers. Amazon, it is the lungs of the planet, and we can barely breathe anymore. Gather together and see what is to be done. We know the risks we take are perilous. We sharpen up our wits for the days ahead to come. Somebody has to, and it might as well be us, because we have the history. We know what we are doing, and we will not just disappear. We're gonna stay. Right.
Good morning. That was Eric Bibb doing the Old Mole song, followed by a clip from Seattle's own Jim Page singing his brilliant song and diss track, Amazon. Yeah, we are definitely going to stay right here. This is Desiree Hellickers, and I'll be your host for this morning's Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial point of view. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. We've got a jam-packed show for you today. First up today, criminalizing solidarity. Historian Rachel Ida Buff talks with Fran Michel about connections between attacks on encampments in support of Palestine and encampments of houseless people, as well as attacks on other forms of collective solidarity and the commons, including migrant caravans and water protectors, and on histories of resistance and indigenous sovereignty. And then eco-disasters in Japanese cinema. Japan has rich traditions of filmmaking and of approaching films as commentary on daily life. But Japanese cinema also offers rich commentary on ecological crises. Jan Hocken talks with University of Oregon professor Rachel Donito about her new book, Eco-Disasters in Japanese Cinema. Donito explains how filmmakers take up Japan's history as victims of U.S. atomic bombings and nuclear testing, as well as of the Fukushima nuclear accident of 2011, and how films registered public ambivalence and repression of the nuclear legacy. A touchstone throughout the book centers on how people both cope with ecological crises and resist the ongoing impacts of toxic industries. And finally, Google in the Gorge. We hear an excerpt of an interview with Salila YM activist water protector Lana Jack that originally ran on the show Creative Frontlines out of KPFK LA. Since the construction of a Google data center in The Dalles, Oregon in 2006, the city has become a magnet for data centers looking for tax breaks and cheap energy and water to power and cool them. Lana Jack talks about the present and future impacts of Google water on the usual and accustomed places of the Salila YM and on Enchiwana, the Columbia River, in an age of drought and climate collapse. And finally, resisting Google in the Gorge. Since the construction of a Google data center in The Dalles, Oregon in 2006, the city has become a magnet for data centers looking for tax breaks and cheap energy and water to power and cool them. As data centers continue to multiply in The Dalles, spurred on by AI, I speak with Salila YM activist and water protector Lana Jack about the present and future impacts of Google water use on the usual and accustomed places of the Salila YM and on Enchiwana, the Columbia River, in an age of droughts and climate collapse. And now, Fran Michel speaks with historian Rachel Ida Buff.
Good morning. I'm Fran Michel, and I'm here with Rachel Ida Buff, a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where she's also affiliated faculty in African and African diaspora studies, gender and women's studies, and Jewish studies. Professor Buff is a historian of migration and immigrant rights movement, and is particularly interested in international political mobilizations and repression from the Cold War to the present. Her most recent book is A for Asylum Seeker, Words for People on the Move, A de Asilo, Palabras para Personas en Movimiento, a bilingual historical glossary of terms. Her current projects include a collection of essays tentatively titled Lost in the Red Scare. She's also published historically informed public-facing essays in various outlets, including Academe, The Boston Review, and Jacobin. She's here today to talk about her essay in the January-February issue of Against the Current, titled The War to End All Encampments, Criminalizing Solidarity. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me on, Fran. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was really struck by your essay because it brings together a number of different fronts in our current collective struggles. And in particular, you make connections between the Gaza Solidarity encampments last spring and the Supreme Court's decision in the Grants Pass case, allowing states to criminalize sleeping on the streets even when there's nowhere else to go. So could you maybe briefly review that Grants Pass case for us before explaining how you see it as related to the suppression of the movement for justice in Palestine?
The Grants Pass case was about the city of Grants Pass wanting to implement very strict rules against public sleeping, not sleeping in public. But anyway, Grants Pass, the city had been struggling with this for a while, and there were some unhoused advocates who were opposing them and saying, you know, we have certain rights. And some lower courts said that the restrictions that the city of Grants Pass had imposed were not constitutional, that you can't be held liable for a basic bodily function like sleeping, that you have certain rights. And the city of Grants Pass decided anyway to take this to the Supreme Court, which, as we know, 6-3 conservative majority agreed to hear it. So I was sort of aware of this last spring. There was an encampment on the campus where I teach from mid-April to early May. It lasted 2 weeks. And so I was very caught up in that and also listening to, you know, the Supreme Court session come down. And I was just very interested in a couple of turns of phrase that came out in the Grants Pass case. You know, the way Justice Gorsuch seemed to really find the idea that groups of people are making common cause and making encampments to sleep together, he seemed to find that anathema. I point this out in the article that a lot of the prose about this, even on a liberal outlet like NPR, presumes that homeless encampments are these sites of like horrible things, drugs, gangs, you know, and implicitly like weird forms of sexuality and families that aren't normal. And, you know, I'm an immigration historian. And I'm like, oh, wow, I'm thinking of Nyan Shaw's wonderful book about the way that the Chinese were demonized as non-heteronormative in San Francisco in the late 19th century. Like, they're weird. They live in households with more than one family. They're doing indecent things. So it kind of like piqued my attention because I was witnessing the beauty of an encampment where unrelated people were sleeping in tents and creating this amazing culture of solidarity and education. And my feeling about our encampment here was so much that as an educator, I never see education outside. I never see education happening randomly on campus, you know, and I was so moved by that. So Gorsuch's words really struck me, and the thing at the end of his opinion where he says, well, you know, one of the objections is this isn't fair, because it targets people who are economically disadvantaged and become unhoused. And Gorsuch, in response, said, no, we would do the same thing if it was a college student pitching a tent on campus. It is June of 2024. I'm like, where did you get that idea, right? So I was like, wow, this is really about demonizing all of it. And I started digging around and I read the case. I listened to some podcasts, some really good legal podcasts about the case. I listened to parts of the argument. And, you know, you see the three liberal justices trying to make basic human rights cases, and it's just getting struck down. And the lawyer for the case, Teresa Evangelos, is just affirmed, like really trying to pull down the notion that people have certain basic rights. And I was like, who are these people? And I found this beautiful article by Winona LaDuke about the law firm Gibson and Dunn, who argued this, saying, these are the folks that are trying to destroy Indigenous sovereignty. They are the people representing the firms that, you know, rough up water protectors and land protectors and throw them in jail. They are the people trying to destroy the Indian Child Welfare Act. You know, they are, she calls them in the article, the modern cavalry. Then I was like, okay, this is the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's a terrible case. It is going to cause horrible suffering because, I mean, one thing that will happen in cities like Grants Pass is people who are unhoused because of financial duress are going to get tickets that are going to cost them more money. And we've been through this. We know that the economy of a place like Ferguson, Missouri is predicated on penalizing African Americans for everything, for parking, for driving with one headlight, you know, this is how those places fund themselves. It's this kind of racist over-policing. And we're going to have more and more of this. And like, I don't exactly understand what the, you know, I understand how draconian this is. I understand how cruel it is. I don't really understand the vision. I mean, there is that 2013 quote that I use in the article where the city administrators in Grants Pass are like, well, maybe they'll just go away. And I do think that that's the wish for a lot of us, that maybe we'll just go away, right? But like, not all unhoused people will go away because we have this terrible housing crisis brought to us, thank you, J.D. Vance, not by undocumented migration, but by greedy real estate speculators. In the city where I live, and I'm betting in the city where most of your listeners live, because this is ubiquitous, there are all these new, really ugly housing developments that are like 10, 15% full, and some rich person is speculating. It's not for normal people to live in, yeah. Right? That's what cities are like.
Yeah, There was just recently a report that houselessness in the U.S. has gone up 18% just in the last year. And it had gone up 20-some percent the year before that. So it's happening everywhere. And a lot of it is, yeah, as you say, it's this Wall Street buying up buildings for investment purposes. And because there's no penalty to them for leaving them empty, they can, if they're not making money off it, they can write it off on their taxes. And of course, people can't afford it because wages have been stagnant. Many people have lost their health because of the pandemic, have fallen into medical debt, have been evicted. So there's sort of a convergence of economic factors that are creating this housing crisis.
I think about this all the time. Like, Milwaukee is still more affordable than a Midwestern city like the Twin Cities, where I did my graduate work and as a grad student could afford a nice apartment. No longer the case at all. Milwaukee is more affordable, but I drive around the city and I think, we have all these unhoused people. It's cold here. We have all these empty buildings. Like, the idea would be like, maybe they could be in there. But like, that's, we're in a regime which prefers to have empty house, empty apartments and people freezing to death than to say, oh, hey, we have a huge vacancy rate in these apartments. And like, let's put families and individuals that need, you know, like we don't think that way. And that's what our country is like. You know, we're gonna tear down in Milwaukee. It's really observable on some of our really beautiful historic streets, like, you know, tear it all down, build these really ugly condo developments that are empty. The people who were able to afford the prior houses get displaced and no one is living there. So it's like we're building our cities for no one except rich people who are not even there either.
And then the solutions in Portland. We have a new mayor coming in and a new city charter. So there have been some changes and there's hope for the future. But our incoming mayor has said he doesn't want to enforce the camping ban unless there are adequate numbers of shelter. So they're spending all this money on shelter, which does not get people permanently housed. Mm-hmm. And instead of creating public housing or rent control, eviction protections. So there are all sorts of solutions that would be more financially logical, it seems. And yet the money is going to these sort of punitive carceral encampments. People aren't allowed to set up their own camps, but they can stay in official camps. There's a lot of panic in the public discourse in Portland about houselessness and a lot of cruelty to people who are unhoused.
Although, it's a class war, right? It's saying these people can never have like an apartment and a normal life. You know, that's what Grants Pass was like. They were like, well, we have a shelter. And it turned out to be like a very evangelical Christian shelter, which, you know, they're only going to recognize certain kinds of relationships. They're going to have incredible rules. You know, and you think about like an unhoused child, right, who's trying to go to school and bumping from shelter to shelter, like that kid's going to have trouble in school. And then that kid's going to be in, you know, the school to prison pipeline, right? So we're talking about creating generations of people who don't have the right to basic fulfilled human needs. I mean, that's what this law firm really is trying to do, is to eviscerate any kind of collective rights that we have. Like, everyone has the right to housing, everyone has the right to education, everyone, you know, like those are being completely eviscerated and it's pay to play.
That firm that argued the Grants Pass case, as you mentioned, also argued cases related to Standing Rock and also, I think, to Chevron in Ecuador and the Steve Donziger case. Why is that part of their picture? How are these things connected? Houselessness, Gaza protests, how is that connected to indigenous sovereignty?
I mean, it's complicated, right? So Rebecca Nagel points this out in her podcast, This Land, that Indian law is not taught in law school unless you go to a place that teaches Indian law. So even liberal justices just don't understand that there's a whole other body of law that governs what Justice John Marshall called in 1832, the nations within. It's very hard for Americans to understand that indigenous folks are sovereign, that they have their own political systems. So that in itself, I think, freaks people out and might ruffle the feathers of right-wing people like the Federalists. That and the fact that this is not taught in law school means that even liberal justices maybe are not always able to articulate the kinds of defenses they should be. And then when we think about just the question of ongoing mineral extraction, right? Which is what the No DAPL movement was about, you know, the land protectors and the water protectors, and what Danziger was working on, you know, is like, you know, the idea that indigenous folks who around our hemisphere are trying to stand up for water and land, trying to stand against climate immiseration. These are things we should be on the side of, right? Because we all need water and we all breathe air. Water is life. Like, that wasn't a statement that was for Indians. That was a biological statement about humanity. But we're going to see a lot of this under the incoming administration. You know, it's drill, baby, drill. And like, those people can't extract. And Leslie Silko predicted this in 1992 in her book, Almanac of the Dead. You know, and she was right about everything. That book is really old, but she was like, that woman is amazing. The people that run, you know, the wealthy, the 1%, it's never going to be enough. They need the last drop of oil. They need the last piece of cobalt to make money off the phone. They need to immiserate the water for all of us so they can build their pipelines.
They built a shiny new temple to themselves downtown. People genuflect as they pass. Artificial sunlight and climate control, so they can colonize the jungle behind a pane of glass. And because Bezos has the money, he's got all of that money clutching in the fingers of his hand. He's a rich man.
Good morning. You're listening to the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was just a little snippet of Seattle's Jim Page singing Amazon. And now we return to Fran Michel speaking with historian Rachel Ida Buff.
I think the Federalist Society has figured out that they have to undermine indigenous sovereignty. And the problem is, I think, that we on the left don't always understand that well. People have really rallied around Standing Rock and here in the Midwest around Line 3 and Line 5, which are two really awful pipelines being built in northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota, respectively. But we don't always understand that indigenous liberation and indigenous politics are related and important to our own liberation, but they are often couched in different terms. But I think the Federalist Society just wants, you know, like, I always tell my students, if you want to talk about Indian history and you want to say it's always about the land, that's really crude and simplistic, but you're right. End of the day, it's always going to be about taking the land away. And it still is. Here we are over 500 years later. And then the other piece of it, of course, is undermining collectivity. The political science Michael Rogan talks about, American politics have always been anti-red. They were anti-Indian and they were anti-communist. And anybody who wants to say, hey, you know, we need each other. Hey, there are other ways of living. Hey, we need to collectivize, becomes the enemy, right? You're a commie if you say that, or you're a dirty Indian if you say that. No, it's the alternative to what we were just talking about, which is empty buildings and people freezing. And, you know, it was so clear to me last spring, I think this is where the article came from, that here are our students doing what I can never make my students do, right? Developing supply chains and distribution chains and schedules for entertainment and lectures every day, all day, and loving it and being open to people who are Muslim and Jewish and Christian and pagan and creating these spaces. And my university could not say, oh my God, you guys, this is so beautiful. They had to say, well, we're under section 4, like no camping, you know, like that blew my mind. That continues. I was just walking across campus. I always miss the encampment when I'm up there now, because I used to stop by for a cup of tea and chat, and there's no place to do that now. It was such, for me as a lifetime college professor, it made me so happy. Like, I've been trying to get my students to do this forever and failing, and now they're doing it themselves.
Because it's meaningful to them, connected to the world, connected to making change that they want to see and making the world that they want to live in. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me also, I mean, as you're talking about the Federalist Society and the need of the 1% to, or the desire of the 1% to extract every last drop of resources out of the dying world, even though it's killing the rest of us, killing all of us ultimately. It seems like the problem here is capitalism, right? And the response to it is that kind of individually oriented property rights that maybe goes back, we could also have seen it in the allotment system, breaking up indigenous collectivity. But it also reminds me of the sort of the response to it in the Powell memo, something like that from the early 70s, when, again, in the 60s and 70s, there's a movement of students on campus working together against war for civil rights, for liberation, and disrupting business as usual. And so Lewis Powell, who later became a Supreme Court justice, wrote this memo for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce arguing that, well, we need to have better propaganda for the system of market capitalism, because these people are learning that there are other ways of doing things, and they're saying bad things about capitalism. And that seems to have been part of fueling all of these right-wing groups, Heritage Society and other groups that have continued that propaganda that leaves people vulnerable to thinking, oh, well, homeless people.
I think implicit in the Powell memo also, and I'm so happy you brought that up, is, I mean, I think what happens is they don't have very good propaganda. It doesn't convince many people. So, you know, there's always the jackboot of repression. You know, like our UW system is rewriting its code, was rewriting its code during the encampments and after. And then our little university, we're like a small campus, spent $50,000 this summer on outside consultants to advise them how to, not to say, oh, okay, we've agreed to divest, we've agreed to like talk to the students, we've agreed to really think about our travel abroad programs in terms of Palestine, we've agreed, you know, not to help them do that. No. They spent $50,000 this summer. How can we publicize well our objection to everything that we signed an agreement with? And how can we essentially undermine the agreement that we ourselves signed? Because that's what they've been doing. And, you know, in the wake of our encampments, one of our student orgs has been suspended for 2 years. Individual students have been suspended for 2 years. Like, that's all they got, because they don't really have very good propaganda that anyone believes. They're not good writers. They're not good thinkers. They don't have a vision for society that anyone likes. They just have me, 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 me. Which attracts some people, sure, but like, they're not afraid to use violence and coercion. That's what capitalism is. Like, everyone knows this is bad for us, this is bad for the planet, this is bad for our relatives in Palestine. It's not hard to see. So they have to figure out another way to shut us up.
So there have been all of these new laws and regulations and crackdowns. Do you see a way forward? Are there ways that people can continue to push back on this?
Ironically enough, you know, I do think their aim, you know, the aim of the Federalist Society, the aim of the incoming administration, like the vision, if you want to dignify it with that, of somebody like J.D. Vance and the Heritage Foundation and Project 2025, they just want to firewall it and shut us up and put us in jail. They're going to criminalize protests. They're going to criminalize solidarity. You know, I was really struck, and the reason I wrote the book that you mentioned, A is for Asylum Seeker, is I was really struck by the way the first Trump administration talked about asylum seekers. I grew up in a Jewish household. To us, the word asylum and refugees were like such beautiful, happy words. I grew up thinking like taking in a refugee is the best thing a country can do. You know, and in 2016, when I started hearing people talk about refugees, like it was a curse word, I got really confused just as an English-speaking person, like, you know, like what's going on here? And that particularly in terms of like the demonization of the migrant caravans, which are, again, people making common cause because they are leaving unbearable situations. Your 13-year-old has been threatened if he doesn't join a gang. They murdered your sister. They broke all the windows of your store and said they were coming back for more. So you flee and you find other people who've had to flee and you make common cause. This to me is a beautiful, amazing, powerful thing. But the notion that these are like terrible people who are like, again, we're back to the drug smuggling purple prose of Chinese exclusion, like that is not, and I've been to Tijuana, I've done solidarity work there, that is not what I saw at all. But you know, people are like, oh, you're going to Tijuana, you know, that's so scary. Like what I saw was people preserving their dignity by helping each other. And the idea that there's a war on that, so that's a long digression to say that, you know, like a lot of people after the election, it's really different than in 2016 when we all had our pink pussy hats at this point and we're out in the streets. I think a lot of us feel like what we need to do is build exactly these networks. We need to build our mutual aid networks. We need to really think about what sanctuary can mean for our undocumented neighbors. We need to love the people we love and create these circles of safety, because it is going to be a long, ugly run. And they're going to criminalize many of the things that the left has typically done. We've been here before, right? You know, this is, I'm just writing a piece about, I think Palestine solidarity is the new communism. It's the new, you know, we have this new McCarthyism, right? Which is, you know, and this is painful to me as a Jewish person, this is facilitated by this fake support of Jewish people, you know, which is a whole other story. But, you know, we could talk about groups like the so-called Anti-Defamation League, which have been on the wrong side of every international issue since about 1965. So yeah, I just think like we need to be very mindful now and very good to one another and really and think about how to move forward, because I think we will be in the streets to the extent that we can be. But I think we also need to think about ways we can take care of each other. You know, so I think like love and solidarity and support, and that means a lot of things. That means that we like abolish the circular firing squad of the left and stop squabbling about dumb stuff, which we're bad about, and just figure out how to support. You know, I studied Spanish with this woman in Guatemala, and she talks about how, and I mentioned this in the article, she talks about how when she was growing up during the genocidal civil wars supported by the United States and Israel in her country, they always had creamers in the refrigerator so that when people were running from the police, they would just pass them through the window to get the tear gas out of their eyes. Like, I think we have to think about that. Like, what's on your shopping list? What might you need? What might the people that are running past your house in fear need? You know, and that's some work. I think that's the work ahead.
Finding ways to connect our movements and protect each other as we're doing that. Because clearly, with the attacks on solidarity, it seems like the right, the 1%, the 0.01% are scared of people coming together. And that's why they're making it harder to do. And that's why it's more important than ever.
No, absolutely. Like when I see the US facilitating Israel's bombing of Yemen, what has Yemen done but said, we will stand with Gaza? That is solidarity. And so they're getting bombed for the crime of trying to stop this horrible year and almost a half long genocide that is completely about the obeisance of our country, of the United States of America, with the arms dealers. You know, it's been great for the stock market. It's been great for all of those like nefarious arms dealers that give to both sides of the party. And it's why Biden and Harris were so intractable around this. And honestly, if they turned off the spigot, it would stop tomorrow.
Yeah.
And they won't. They can't. And it's about the addiction of the United States since its founding to murder and colonization, and the foundations of our country are in blood, and we continue that tradition going forward.
But as you say in your article, we also have this inheritance of solidarity and collectivity, even though there is a tradition of it being constantly villainized. We do have precedents in history of people coming together and helping each other, and we need to call on that inheritance and build on it going forward.
Yeah, and this is the war on so-called woke, right? You know, so the anti-woke attacks on, you know, high school and colleges and diversity is like, we're not even supposed to remember our stories. We're not supposed to remember that organization that existed, you know, the American Committee for the Protection of the Foreign Born, that existed from 1934 till 1980 and defended every single cohort of immigrants that came through. We're not supposed to remember that that's possible. Right? We're supposed to think like, oh God, you know, there's another horrible deportation raid. What are we going to do? Instead of being like, oh, hey, what did they do in 1956? How did they, you know, how did they fight Operation Wetback at the border? You know, we have these stories and they want to get rid of that. That's how demonic their programs are. Not only do they want to get rid of our movements, they want to get rid of the memory of our movements, you know, so that we don't have this beautiful, deep, rich history that you were just referring to of like, oh yeah, we've been here before. And, you know, in desperate times, this is what people before us came and we stand on their shoulders. Like that's such a beautiful, important thing. And they want to get rid of that too and have us like not, you know, we're supposed to teach American history without mentioning slavery.
Hard to see how that would work.
Well, it wouldn't, right? Yeah. And that's the idea.
That's the idea. Well, thank you so much, Rachel Ida Buff, for talking with us today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We will link on our webpage when we post this conversation to your article, The War to End All Encampments, Criminalizing Solidarity.
Thank you so much for reading my piece, and it's so great to talk to you, Fran.
Thank you so much.
طلعت علي البنت هاي من فوق لتحت حكت شوف الاختلاف انا احلامك حياتك اللي فيها كل شي بتتمنيه فيها عيونك الحلوات بتحب تشوف تعالي جربي خلي راسك مرتاح بعيد عن الهموم غمضت عيوني رجعت للظلم العايش فيه الواقع المربط.
Good morning, you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Itija doing Bali Hadood or Without Borders. Itija is an all-women's rap group making music in Diyashe refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. And before that, Fran Michel was speaking with historian Ida Buff about criminalizing solidarity. Next up, Jan Hocken talks with University of Oregon professor Rachel DeNito about her book, Eco-Disasters in Japanese Cinema.
Welcome to KABU, Rachel Donito.
Thanks for having me, Jan.
Well, I appreciate you joining me on the Old Mole today to talk about your gripping new book, Eco-Disasters in Japanese Cinema. You're a professor of Japanese literature at the University of Oregon and have published extensively on representations of nuclear issues in film, literature, and popular culture. As editor of this new book, you begin the introduction with an intriguing pitch. Japanese cinema, you say, is known for its spectacular scenes of disaster, unquote. Well, I want to focus today on some of the chapters on nuclear anxiety and disasters, but let's start with what Japanese cinema offers as commentary on eco-disasters. What would you say is kind of the broad arc of that claim?
I think broadly speaking, the Japanese cinema offers a number of different things. So it offers something specifically for people in Japan who've experienced the atomic bombs, the Fukushima nuclear disaster, right? Other instances of industrial poisoning. It speaks to those people, but it also isn't, what I like about it is it's not just about Japan, right? These are environmental disasters that affect all kinds of people around the planet. So I think there's a way to read the films that we try to do in the book to talk broadly beyond just Japan problems and allow us to think more about what does it mean to experience environmental problems from, you know, we're really thinking about the 1950s up until the present day.
Yeah, and I was particularly interested in how many of the contributors weave stories of horror, ongoing set of horror stories, with resistances and activism and forms of movement building around these disasters, which I think is often missing in the whole disaster genre. You know, you mentioned the Japan's history of as victim of atomic bombing by the U.S. of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. You also open with a lesser known part of the history of U.S. Occupation of Japan with nuclear testing in the years that followed and the propaganda campaigns and how the U.S. governed a lot of the discourse about nuclear and what you call the good atom and the bad atom. We're seeing that, of course, have seen that elsewhere with nuclear power. Can you talk about the one example I think listeners are most familiar with, which is the Godzilla monster films, most well-known genre that clearly evoke the history of the atomic bombing of Japan. What can you say about that genre? Hibakusha films,
yeah.
Is the genre.
Yeah, so this term hibakusha is a term that's used really specifically to talk about victims of the atomic bombings, but since then has been broadened out to be used more widely for any kind of victim of nuclear exposure, right? And the Godzilla films, you know, the initial film sometimes gets not quite the credit it deserves because looking back on it now from the 21st century, the guy in the big rubber suit seems a little bit, you know, less, not what quite what we're used to in terms of high-tech CGI, right?
That was 1954 version.
1954, yeah. But it's important to go, if you go back and watch that film was really dramatic for viewers in Japan when it came out because there is reference in the film to the atomic bombings, verbal reference in the film. And then there's also visual images that clearly evoke the atomic bombings. And it's said that when viewers were in the theaters, they came out of the theaters in tears after watching that Godzilla film because the imagery is so powerful. And there's so much war imagery in that film too, as they're battling this monster, right?
And that was such a recent collective trauma of a
exactly
magnitude.
Yeah.
So audiences knew how to read it. It was not only operating on a metaphorical level or symbolic.
Not at all. I mean, it's, you know, less than 10 years had passed since the atomic bombing. So I think, just the memory of the atomic bombings and then all the trauma of the war itself was very much packaged in that film. And it hit viewers on a really emotional level. in a way that I think now we've kind of lost that sense of impact that the initial film had. And the films went on to be this incredibly lucrative, you know, franchise, right, for these monster films that at different points in time has revisited in a little more depth the nuclear issue. But I wonder sometimes how much your average Godzilla fan knows about the initial, right, inspiration for the films. And if I can just one other quick comment, the film was re-edited for an American audience. I don't know how widely this is known, but the original Godzilla film was re-edited. They edited Raymond Burr into the film as an American newsman who was in Japan observing this monster attack. And they edited out the dialogue about the atomic bombs. That film became then really popular in the US. And then it was re-imported back into Japan. It was really popular in Japan again.
So you also talk some in the in your, I think it was in your introduction as well as your own chapter, on representations of Japan in American films, and Japan is this very lush, somewhat idyllic but kind of primitive forest, a kind of paradise. Can you say something about that? You also talk about representations of nature in Japan as it comes to embody nature, both its fearsomeness with earthquakes, and you know the terrain is also has a kind of mystery to it and a foreboding aspect as well as arresting beauty. Can you say something about that part of your thesis and how Japan gets represented in American films?
Yeah, so I think the Japan's representation in America's films really peaked in this kind of golden age of Japanese cinema in the 1950s. And that wasn't just America, but really globally, Japan was winning international awards. And a lot of these films are period pieces, so they represent a Japan from the, you know, hundreds of years earlier. They're set in these rural settings and they tell these kind of sometimes fable-like tales, right? Those films by famous directors like Akira Kurosawa went on to win international awards and I think set the stage for this image of Japan as this place that where people lived in harmony with nature, right? And Japan was also promoting that view too. And then you see it in kind of GI films that followed again when Technicolor came out. So it's interesting to contrast that to this idea of Japan as a place that, what we argue in the book, really actively pursued a war on nature, right? As they, you know, went through industrialization, right? As many countries have, right? And a kind of war on the environment. And you can see all this environmental harm in a number of these films. So the book was an attempt to help viewers see both of those images and in some ways to allow us to kind of look underneath this image of Japan as this beautiful place of nature and harmony and think a little more about what happened as Japan was progressing and modernizing and what were the negative effects on nature and on the people in Japan.
So, and you do take that up with Fukushima and the revisiting of the horrors, the return of the repressed in a sense of the horrors of the nuclear project and atomic weapons that move into, you know, atomic power, nuclear power. How do you describe, as you've taken it up, I think in the opening and the conclusion of the book, that the atomic legacy going from, you know, what you call the bad atom or the bad nuclear to the good nuclear, where nuclear power tries to offer a kind of redemptive story of the destructiveness of atomic power, but also that redemptive story exploded massively with Fukushima.
Absolutely. And so in Japan, we talk about the myth of safety that was surrounding these ideas of nuclear power. As you mentioned earlier, the US government persuaded Japan to import nuclear power soon after the war, but very much, you know, plants start getting built in the 70s, early 70s in Japan. And there is this idea of there's atomic weapons and there's nuclear power, and nuclear power is safe. And this, it was seen as safe, cheap energy that was necessary for Japan to modernize after the war. And the nation bought into it in many respects. And so that myth, as you said, absolutely shatters when the Fukushima plant explodes. Because unlike the atomic bombs, when you could blame the Americans for dropping the bombs, who are you going to blame for the Fukushima disaster except themselves, right? The Japanese could only blame themselves. So it is this important moment of an awakening. Many authors and critics talk about, you know, opening their eyes to how could I not have realized this? We were in this situation. Japan was the third most nuclear-friendly nation on the earth.
Yeah, it seemed puzzling.
Really puzzling. Yeah. Like what happened in that moment? How did this kind of nuclear amnesia take hold?
Yeah, right? I mean, some of it was the U.S. occupation and the propaganda and the constraints on Japan, but you're saying there are other dynamics that are not reducible to that, or it's overdetermined maybe in a complicated way.
Yeah, I do think this you know, the post-war economic miracle, as they call it in Japan. Something had to power that economic miracle, and nuclear power provided this really cheap source of energy. And I think a lot of people were willing to kind of look the other way and enjoy this prosperous lifestyle while, you know, willingly forgetting the costs of nuclear in Japan. And that all fell apart in 2011.
So how is that represented in films? Are there particular films that come to mind that kind of capture some of those shifts? Since Fukushima, there's, I think, less focus on how that gets expressed in films versus the atomic bombings, where there are a lot of films and there's a lot of literature on films related to that over quite an extensive period of time, but not so much films that deal with more contemporary environmental disasters, including Fukushima.
So there are a number of ways in which contemporary film deals with the Fukushima disaster. One are documentary films that are really interested in on-the-ground kind of work, interviewing people in the affected area, how they're going to continue to live their lives now that their homes, their livelihoods have been irradiated, right? And those are really important films. There are other films that show people, as you mentioned earlier, activism, fighting against the push to have a nuclear power plant in their backyards. And then there are films like, to go back to Godzilla, Shin Godzilla, this film that came out after the nuclear disaster that kind of imagines Godzilla through these new nuclear metaphors coming out of the power plant accident.
What's the name of the film?
It's called Shin Godzilla, S-H-I-N. Yeah, and it's in the chapter about Godzilla mentions that film.
Is that available for people that to find?
Yes, that should be easy to find. At the end of the film, you know, Godzilla is left standing in the middle of Tokyo and he's frozen because they inject him with this freezing solution and they don't know when or if he's going to wake up. So people have read it as this metaphor for these nuclear power plants that are, you know, trying to decommission or trying to shut down or trying to cool them down, but the danger is still really present. So that film does an interesting take on the ever-presentness of the danger and our inability to look away.
Yeah, and the call to awaken to what is driven there and here by the very aggressive forms of capitalism in the harnessing of nature in the most brutal, short-term, exploitive way. Does that become part of the activism there, or is it fighting one monster on each corner, which often is what you have to do, you know, because there are so many of them, but it's also part of a larger system. Is there that kind of reach to any of the activism looking at, you know, what kind of political economy have we built and participated in?
There was a huge just outpouring. I mean, there have been sort of slow and steady anti-nuclear movements since the atomic bombings, but this huge explosion of anti-nuclear activism after the Fukushima disaster happened. and almost a complete reversal of support for nuclear power. Whereas you previously had, you know, 60-70% in favor of nuclear power, you had 60-70% against nuclear power. And then what happened, thinking about capitalism and global capitalism, the war in Ukraine made energy much more expensive in Japan. So importing liquid nuclear gas, right, importing oil became much more expensive. And then you saw a shift in Japan that people decided, oh, maybe we should restart those nuclear reactors, right? And then again, interestingly, just about a year ago, there was an earthquake in Japan, and people, that really kind of shook people up. And numbers started rising again in terms of, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should put the brakes on this nuclear program. Maybe we don't want to, maybe we shouldn't be restarting those old reactors. As you know, these reactors are all really old, right? Built in the 70s and 80s. So it is shifting in interesting ways. It's difficult because the media always doesn't give it the kind of coverage it needs. The government is very pro-nuclear, so it's an uphill battle in the same ways it is here in the U.S.
Yeah. So in closing, tell us how to find your book. And I also wanted to put in my own personal pitch for it. I mean, it's a very scholarly book, beautiful scholarship, but it's also it's a great read, full of insightful commentary, fascinating examples, and the line of eco-criticism that you pursue, very fulfilling. So that's my pitch at the close.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Tell listeners how to find the book.
You can search for Asia Schwartz, Columbia University Press, and you can find the book through their website. You can also just put the title in and search it through Google, and you should come to the website of the publisher. Is the place I'd recommend people go.
Uh-huh. Eco-Disasters in Japanese Cinema. Well, thank you so much, Rachel Donito, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jen.
Put down that bag of potato chips, that white bread, that bottle of pop. Turn off that cell phone, computer, and remote control. Open the door, then close it behind you. Take a breath offered by friendly winds. They travel the earth gathering essences of plants to clean. Give it back with gratitude. If you sing, it will give your spirit lift to fly to the stars' ears and back. Acknowledge this earth who has cared for you since you were a dream planting itself precisely within your parents' desire.
That was Joy Harjo doing Calling the Spirit Back. And before that, you were listening to Jan Hawkins speaking with University of Oregon Professor Rachel Donito about their book, Eco-Disasters in Japanese Cinema. Next, we hear an interview with Salila Wayam activist and water protector Lana Jack. The segment entitled Salila Falls and the Culture of Death was produced by filmmaker Robert Lundahl and journalist tracker Gina Marie Rangel Quinones for their show Creative Frontlines on LA's KPFK. We will post the full segment when we post the show. Oregonian reporter Mike Rogaway fought a protracted legal battle to gain access to data on Google's water use. As Rogaway reported in 2023, the data showed that, quote, Google's water use in the Dalles has nearly tripled in the past 5 years, and the company's data centers now consume more than a quarter of all the water used in the city, unquote. In the interview with Lundahl and Quinones, Lana Jack speaks about the present and future impacts of Google water use on the usual and accustomed places of the Salila Wayam and on Enchiwana, the Columbia River, in an age of droughts and climate collapse.
One of the things that's been brought to my attention here and that I've been following and watching and going to the meetings of the city council here at the Dalles, Oregon, and the county commissioners of Wasco County, these discussions, they take and make agreements, water agreements, that I completely disagree with because they're sitting on our usual and accustomed sites. And the reciprocity of who we were as a people doesn't even exist anymore. The bifurcated process has kept us divided even as she's perishing before our eyes with green algae all up and down. I can't show it to you. I wish I could, but I drive up and down the river praying for our river. He's hot. Too many dams on his river. And now Google wants to come in and take trillions of gallons of water from the creeks, the aquifer it sits on. They're going to divert, the city and county have colluded to divert water from one creek to the aquifer. But this creek, Mill Creek, that they're talking about diverting to the aquifer here this winter, is already had a river diverted to it 100 years ago. They just replaced the pipe, the Dog River. You see, Tenino means the Dog River Indians. Tenino is where we met our relatives, our close relatives, in this relationship of reciprocity, different bands of people, different dialects, clearly different ways. We're a longhouse people here, seven drum religion, Washup people, dancers, medicine dancers. They desecrated everything about us to take our water rights from us, to take our usual and accustomed sites from us. So, and they did away with us as a people, so nobody could be here to tell them or remind them of their thieving ways. But I'm here as the last of my people, and I say that with great anguish. My heart, my soul, because my river and I, we share the same fate. We were made to perish behind Congress's moves to extinguish our sovereignty and right here at Salila Village. Now, Google gets to be the supreme law of the land. They're going to own the Dalles Dam.
And this is because they have the data processing operations that have lots of servers, computer servers. And
they've had one here, one data center for 10 years that sits right on the aquifer and sits right on the Columbia River and sits on Taylor Lake. Taylor Lake was where we harvested our trout for our usual and accustomed food for trout and sturgeon, both of them, on the Columbia River side. But the Taylor Lake was where we harvested our trout as we traveled up Chenoweth Creek to meet, or Mill Creek, to meet with our Dog River Indians who have already been harvesting elk and deer and huckleberries. We traded there. It's an ancient route for us. They both are. And that's what we're denied at the heart of it as Salila Wyam Indians. And I can see why, because they wanted those water rights more than anything. And they wanted Salila more than Salila Falls more than anything. When a multi-billion dollar industry can come in here and take over our water and kill it, it's like the final nail for her. She can't take much more. She's showing us. She's showing us worldwide. She can't take no more. Worldwide, she's dumping entire rivers on the heads of people that have been displaced. We look like we have water here compared to most of the world, but we're in the illusion that we have water because it's hardly even safe to drink at all, much less for the Dalles to have the liability to feed this aquifer so that Google can use trillions and trillions of water.
You were just listening to an excerpt of an interview with Salila Wyam activist water protector Lana Jack that was produced by filmmaker Robert Lundahl and journalist tracker Gina Marie Rangel Quinones for their show Creative Frontlines on LA's KPFK. We'll post the link to the full segment when we post today's show. This is Desiree Helgers, and I've been your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Many thanks to today's guests
historian Rachel Ida Buff, professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and Professor Rachel Donito of the University of Oregon. Thanks also to the Moles Fran Michel and Jan Hocken for contributing interviews for today's show, and also to Patricia Kohlberg, Mole Wrangler extraordinaire, for their editing work on today's show. And again, we will post the full segment to the interview with Lana Jack, which ran on Creative Frontlines on KPFK. And we're going to play out with Joy Harjo calling the spirit back.
Let the earth stabilize your post-colonial insecure jitters. Be respectful of the small insects, birds, and animal people who accompany you. Ask their forgiveness for the harm we humans have brought down upon them. Don't worry. The heart knows the way. Though there may be high-rises, interstates, checkpoints, armed soldiers, massacres, wars, and those who will despise you because they despise themselves. The journey might take you a few hours, a day, a year, a few years, 100, 1,000, or even more. Watch your mind. Without training, it might run away and leave your heart for the immense human feast set by the thieves of time. Do not hold regrets. When you find your way...
KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported KBOO during our Catalog of Connections year-end